Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining this week is my favorite politician in New York politics, Comptroller Tom DiNapoli. Welcome back, Tom, and I apologize for telling you how much I like you because it will probably cost you votes.
Well, I will accept whatever damage comes from that. That's an honor to have you feel that way, Alan. Thank you.
So there's a Quinnipiac poll out today. I don't think you've probably seen it yet, but Cuomo wins big. Cuomo gets 43% in a general election, Molinaro 23%, Nixon 13%. He does better among women. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, a couple things. First of all, the governor has a pretty good record. And certainly in terms of women's issues, he's been very outspoken in terms of, you know, the current concern about the Supreme Court change and for New York to update our laws on women's reproductive health and choice and protecting the freedom that has come with the freedom of choice that comes with Roe v. Wade. So that doesn't surprise me. He's got a very famous name in New York politics. You know, that's obviously a strength. And, you know, incumbency tends to have advantages. So when you add all that up, and the fact that I think most people are more focused at the national level than state level right now, I think the governor comes into the picture with a lot of advantages, so I'm not surprised that he'd be ahead.
Now, while we're on the subject of the governor, I wanted to ask you something. One of the things that I think that he has done that is most reprehensible, along with some of your old friends in the New York State Legislature, is to take away from you some real important powers that you had to audit not-for-profits that have been created by the legislature and others. And we now think, based on history, that it is entirely possible that the Buffalo Billions case, Elaine Kelly-Arros, and everything else wouldn't have happened had you been able to blow the whistle early. Why in the world did they take those powers away from you?
Well, you know, this has been a concern that I've had for a number of years now, and the why had to do with so-called efficiency, the notion that if there's additional oversight on these contracts and these kinds of payments that flow, that would slow down the process, and the urgency of getting money spent on economic development required a more short-circuited process. Now, we didn't agree with that at the time, Alan. We talked about this years ago, and while I don't know if we had our oversight maintained, would we have caught some of these things? I don't know that for a fact. I'd like to think we might have, but more importantly, I think when you create the reality that there is not an independent review and independent oversight, people who think they can get away with something are going to try to. And in this case, we had folks that were very much on the inside, both in terms of government and people who had close associations with, you know, with the administration, you know, that really gamed the system. And I think the message here is, what do we do moving forward? And we've got our procurement reform bill that I have put forward that would restore our oversight on the construction contracts, on the centralized contracts that was taken away. It's really that pre-audit function that was really here. Well, we could audit things after the fact, but it doesn't matter. If the money's out the door and spent inappropriately, You could certainly call it out, but it doesn't mean as much as reviewing ahead of time. And not using, I mean, you touched on it, the establishment of these nonprofits through SUNY as a way to funnel money, again, without the same kind of scrutiny that a normal agency payment process, a contract process would have. So opaque, totally not transparent, and that's where, you know, the abuses come in. And part of our proposal is to say, you're not going to create those kind of nonprofits anymore. Yeah, that's not the way to do business. And the other piece, the database of deals that many of the reform groups have been pushing for, so there's a more clear accounting of what kind of money is being spent on economic development. So past is past, but let's, as we move forward, let's correct it for the future. Those two bills are a great way to start.
You don't really think that governor, with everything he's done to you, is going to go for all of this, do you?
Well, you know, you never know. This year, the Senate passed the bills, and they hadn't been passing it. Now, part of that may be that the, you know, the Senate Republicans after the IDC went back with the Democrats, at least for now, they may have felt burned by all of that, so they passed it. You know, for whatever reason, they passed it. I was disappointed because I know many members of the Assembly, rank-and-file members, were supportive of these reforms, that it wasn't brought up for a vote, because I'm sure that it would have gotten a majority of Democrats, and I venture to say it would have gotten a majority of the Republicans as well. So I'm hopeful. You know me, Alan, I'm always hopeful. With these latest convictions from the Buffalo Billion trial and the earlier convictions, and I hope when the legislators and even the governor, when they're out, you know, meeting voters heading into the elections, they're going to hear that people want to see a change. They're very concerned about the ethics in the state on a host of areas, but certainly in terms of how we spend money and how we have been handling economic development, we need reform and change. And in a campaign, if the questions come up enough, yeah, maybe the legislators and maybe the governor will say, you know what, we're going to take a fresh look at the proposals that are out there, and we're going to do business in a different way moving forward. Yeah, I'm hopeful that there'll be a change.
So why are the guys in the legislature who know this? I mean, the man who is the speaker now, Speaker Hasty, who I call Boss Hasty because he was the boss in the Bronx and now is the boss in the legislature. Why wouldn't he understand how important what you're saying is?
I like to think that they do, but obviously when you're closing out a session or when you're closing out a budget, this is the other opportunity for them to look at this. You have a lot of issues that are on the table, and you know, for at this point for the leadership, it's very clear that this issue was not as important as other issues that they were negotiating as part of the end of session or part of the budget process. So, again, it's going to take the public pressing legislators to press the leadership to say, you know, you need to get this done. And again, for whatever their motivation, the fact that the state Senate passed both of these reform proposals, I think, puts a lot more pressure on the Assembly, rightfully so. And I'm hoping those in the Assembly who have told me that they're very supportive and have been disappointed it hasn't been brought up for a vote, that they're going to communicate that to the Speaker. And we'll see. You know, there's a lot of rumors they may come back over the summer. Probably they'll come back after Election Day. There is the opportunity still for us to address this year, and we shouldn't let up the pressure to try to have that happen.
Yeah, disappointed, disappointed. The fact of the matter is, you know, the rank and filers are the so-called good ones, the ones we all know are good people. You know, if they really went to the Speaker en masse and insisted that there be some reform in the system, they'd probably get something. But, you know, I think they hide behind the fact that he becomes the bad guy in all this.
Well, you know, there are so many other areas of reform as well. You know, we're coming off of the Skelos retrial.
I want to talk about that. Okay, stop.
Yeah, I mean, so in terms of ethics, disclosure, you still have the other side. A lot of talk about, you know, pay raise. So there's a lot of moving parts right now on that agenda. But I certainly think that the legislature, those who are in office and want to get reelected, if they want to respond to the concerns of their constituents, that they should be very clear about the kind of reforms that they're supporting, because people care and people don't understand why Albany continues to have this reputation as a place where a lot of bad things happen. And we've got to do something to turn that perception around. And the reality is that requires new and stronger laws on how we spend money, on procurement, on disclosure, on transparency. And a piece of it is what we've been talking about with contracts and procurement. But, you know, there's other areas too. And, Alan, it does still, from my point of view, gets back to how we fund our campaigns. I mean, you can give over $60,000 in one contribution to a statewide candidate. And with using the LLCs, you can multiply that how many times, depending on how many LLCs you have. The amount of money, it's outrageous. And that, in and of itself, I think, so undermines the sense of fairness in our system, the sense of a level playing field. And until we get to that, you know, so much of what goes off the rails, I think, could be tied to that whole process. And, of course, not having enough competitive elections, the issue of redistricting that you've been very eloquent on over the years. I mean, there's a lot about the system that people feel they just can't move it. And sometimes, you know, when reforms don't happen, that certainly feeds into that, the accuracy of that perception.
And they give up. I'm going to give you a blue book exam, being a professor of some sort. And that is that I want you to take these two questions. Dean and Adam Skelos, or Dean Skelos, being convicted again for trying to get the kid a job. The Buffalo, you know, that being regarded as graft. The Buffalo Billions trial, Elaine Calieros, who was once considered untouchable in New York State, convicted of bid rigging, rigging it so that only the people who were giving the money to the governor's campaign were basically, you know, being rewarded with contracts and phony contracts. Could you talk a little bit about this culture of corruption in both of those cases and whether or not that is literally replicated every day, that there wouldn't be enough jail cells to put everybody into?
Well, you know, I'm not sure it's that extreme, but when people at the highest level, and so certainly when you're talking about the former Senate Majority Leader, and obviously you have the former Speaker going back a couple of months, also on a retrial, convicted again, and in the case of the spending on economic development, the earlier trial in the year, you know, people close to the governor very involved, and then in the most recent Buffalo Billion, Calleros, who, as you know, many in the capital region would argue did a number of good things, but seemingly to curry favor, ended up doing some very bad things that benefited people who had given big money in the political campaign. So I don't know that it's a legion of folks that are doing that, but the real concern is these are people in the highest levels of government and the highest levels of responsibility. They should be, you know, the best and the smartest. And in fact, they were doing things they shouldn't have been doing. And when you really look at it, they're doing some very dumb things also. And we do have to say that whatever weaknesses there are in the laws to prevent this from happening, we have to give credit to the prosecutors. And in this case, largely, we're talking about the Southern District, not that there aren't other corruption issues that
in other words, the federal prosecutors, the state prosecutors.
Yeah. Well, you know, there was an attempt with the Moreland Commission. And of course, Some of what came out of this was because of the early demise of the Moreland Commission. And that warranted, from the perspective of Pripahara and the federal prosecutors, another look. And this is where, you know, the cases were developed. So, hey, if folks are still thinking they're going to get away with something, you know, the message is, and we even say this, Alan, when we do one of our collaborations with the AG or a local DA, when, you know, it's a village clerk or, you know, a fire district treasurer, if you think you're going to get away with it, you know what, actually, eventually you are going to get caught. And I don't know why people just don't learn. I mean, you're talking about people with not only status and obviously economic security, right? Nobody's paid more than Calleros. Is it worth jeopardizing your reputation and your livelihood and all the money being spent on legal fees? You know, for what? I mean, you look at this and you say, was it really worth it? And the answer obviously is no. But this should be a very hard lesson and a very clear warning for everybody else. Doesn't mean we can't rely just on the prosecutors, Alan. We got to get back to changing the fundamentals of the system. Campaign finance reform, reform how we're doing procurements, more emphasis on making sure there's disclosure with legislators, limiting or eliminating outside income. I mean, these are all the kind of reforms that many have talked about, and it does get back to the public. They've got to raise this issue in the campaigns when they're meeting the candidates.
I'm with you, brother. Now, I wanted to ask you a personal question. I think our listeners will be interested. You've known all these people. I mean, you knew Shelley Silver. I knew him. He was on our programs all the time. You certainly knew Skelos. You had to deal with him and negotiate with him. What does that leave you with when you see guys making these kinds of mistakes and likely to be shut up, maybe for the rest of their lives? I'm asking for a personal reaction.
No, I mean, look, yes. I mean, you know, obviously from when I arrived in Albany, Shelley Silver and Dean Skelos were there. You know, Dean's from my county. You know, we worked on legislation together. Shelley was the speaker of, you know, and the leader of our Democratic conference. These are people I've known well. And people I've seen did a number of good things in their public careers. The inability to understand, though, that you're what you do in your private life is just as important. And by private life, I mean, you know, in Dean's case, putting undue pressure to help his son. And in Shelley's case, the blurred line between people you interact with in your public responsibilities and then getting money, monetizing, in a sense, you know, the relationships. I mean, to me, these two individuals seem to me to be smarter than that, and clearly they weren't. Now, is money the motivation in one case? Is trying to help a kid who had some issues motivation? Either way, the motivations should not have resulted in those kinds of actions. And maybe 10 years ago, you know, 20 years ago, something like this would have never percolated to the top of the attention of prosecutors. But thankfully, I mean, this is a positive instead of just bemoaning what we're not doing. I think there is a heightened level of scrutiny on the actions of public officials, particularly, more of a focus on corruption, probably long overdue. Again, credit to the prosecutors. We see it even in our own office. We have expanded our investigative unit. We've had that collaboration first with AG Schneiderman. It continues now with AG Underwood, with a joint task force on public integrity. We have very close relationships with the DAs across the state and the FBI, and go down the list of law enforcement. There is more attention being paid, because I think people understand the public, especially in a time post-global financial crisis, limited resources, taxpayer dollars are precious. Anybody that's gaming the system to enrich themselves or stealing direct, I mean, all there's zero tolerance for that, and there should be. If you had asked me 20 years ago that I think Shelley Silver or Dean Skelos would fall into this trap of temptation and do these things, you know, I would have said no. But, you know, the facts are what the facts are.
So let me move from there. We don't have that much time left. I want to ask you, Governor Cuomo is suing, along with some other states, the federal government for the cap on how much of our state and local taxes can be deducted. And what do you make of that as your role, Tom DiNapoli, as controller?
Well, there's no doubt that the changes at the federal level with tax reform and capping state and local tax deductibility is going to hurt people in New York and ultimately hurt the state. And the governor was very clear about that when it was being proposed. And also in the state budget, he had some suggestions in terms of changing, you know, income tax and payroll tax and setting up charitable trusts as an alternative way to pay property taxes. I'm not sure that those are going to have a broad application. So he's taking the next step and doing it in concert with other states, saying, hey, this was basically a direct hit, a political agenda to disadvantage certain states in the union based on their voting patterns. And that's wrong. And now, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not sure what the prospects are for a court to decide that. Even if a court would say, yeah, the blue states were targeted, I don't, the American history is about winners and losers, and do the victors go the spoils. So I'm not sure, you know, legally where it all goes. But I think the governor's right to give it a shot, to try. I'm glad it's done in concert with other states. I know New Jersey, I forgot all the states that are on the list, but other states are involved as well. And I hope it has an impact. And I hope, particularly for the members of the majority that are running in our state for Congress, that they have to answer for this. And I know some of them voted against it, even though it was against what the Republicans were pushing. But you know what? We need to change the leadership in Washington, and I really think that particularly, I mean, not to be overly partisan, but the Republicans have a lot to answer to right now, and that's not even getting into all the stuff that Trump has been up to lately. I hope people don't get turned off. I hope people get turned on, come out to vote. 2016 taught us, Alan, elections matter.
Boy, do they ever.
They matter big time, and anybody who has any other opinion of that, just look at what's happening right now. And in America, there's always another election, always a chance to change direction. It could certainly start this year.
Let's talk real quickly, if we can, about the benefits of marijuana. If we recreationalize, if we take all limits off and people are allowed to buy marijuana, will that help, Mr. Controller, will that help the state finances?
Well, just so the Department of Health report came out, I think their estimate was around, could be $600 million in additional revenue. We haven't done our own revenue estimate. It might. My thought, though, on that would be we shouldn't legalize it because of the money. I don't think that's a valid, that should not be the valid reason. And certainly look at what happened with gaming. You know, we were going to get this great windfall, all this money from all these casinos. Well, they're all falling short. So I would not be surprised if whatever generous estimates there are for how much revenue we'd receive from legalized marijuana, if they would probably fall short as well. But I think the marijuana question better be decided on the merits of it, not because of a revenue impact.
Well, let me ask you, Tom DiNapoli, our wonderful controller. I wanted to ask you about the Janus ruling in the Supreme Court. And basically what they said is if you're not going to be a member of the union, they can't force you to pay. To get represented and pay. What will that cost the unions and potentially the state?
Well, it won't cost the state anything. We do the payroll for the state, so we are implementing the Janus decision. So of the about 255,000 state employees, including SUNY and CUNY that are on our payroll, about 31,000 are non-members. So starting with the July payroll, they will no longer be deducted the, you know, the agency fee, the union dues. So it will have a financial impact on the unions. Again, it varies. We have a number of unions. Some have a higher percentage of membership versus others. A quick estimate, and again, it's just an estimate, is probably, around 9.2, maybe a little higher, $1 million loss in terms of money going to the public sector unions. That does not include local government employees, New York City employees, which obviously is a much, much higher count when you add that in. Look, it's going to have an impact on the unions in short run in terms of the dues they're getting. I do think the unions were not surprised by Janus. They've been preparing. They've been reminding their members how important it is to be part of the union. I did not agree with the Janus decision, but we will implement it. And, Alan, you know what? Instead of being negative, I'm going to venture that it's going to put a challenge to the union leadership to reconnect with the rank and file and remind people the value of union, tremendous value. And you know what? All the naysayers that say, well, this is going to put an end to public sector unionism and really weaken them. You know what? Let's look at the numbers a year or two from now. I suspect in New York you're not going to see a big change, and I'll venture you might even see an uptick in terms of some of the union's membership. So it's a change climate. It's a court that is certainly proven to be anti-labor, and that trend will probably continue. But we have a lot of smart union people in the state that I think will rise to that challenge.
So, Tom DiNapoli, the key word this year, Trump and everything else, is immigration. Mm. And so the question is, how much do illegal immigrants contribute to New York state economy? Have you tried to estimate this?
Well, we look at immigration broadly. We were just down in the Mohawk Valley. We did an economic snapshot, and the Mohawk Valley is certainly a case where immigration has had a very strong and a very, very positive impact. That's a part of the state that's been losing population, and they still are, but part of what's backfilling the population loss, those that are moving out of the area, it's the immigrants coming in. You go to a city like Utica, that's where we were the other day, I mean, close to 20% of their population is foreign-born, and Mayor Palmieri will tell you the immigrants have come into the communities where, you know, houses were empty and neighborhoods were falling apart, and they've revitalized them. You know, what percentage of those are legal versus illegal, I can't tell you that, but there's no doubt that this disparaging of immigrants is wrong. In the Mohawk Valley, in the Utica area, they actually have a refugee resource center that's doing it the right way, putting a positive on how to help refugees come into the society, not only get jobs, education, legalize their status, all of which is what the story should be about. So without immigrants, I mean, just look at the agricultural sector. Who's going to be doing the harvesting? Look at our restaurants and hospitality sector. Who's filling those jobs? So, and I've been hearing from some business people, because of what's happening at the national level, they're finding it harder to find people to employ. So, you know, we need a more rational system. There's no doubt about it. The separating of families is horrendous, and not what America is about. But, you know, we all have immigrant roots, and this negativity about what immigration is all about is just so, it's so wrong. And so, from my point of view, it's not my family story. It's not the American story.
Okay, real quickly, you got to invest all the state's money or the pension funds. That's a huge job for you and the people you employ, obviously, to do all of this. Is the stock market keeping up with your expectations? And we only have a minute to do that in.
Well, it's been a little volatile in 2018, but it's starting to bounce back. And we have confidence in our long-term asset allocation. We ended last year at about $207 billion, an historic high for us. So we're not just dependent on the stock market, but we still are one of only four states that's over 90% funded with our pension plan. So we're in good shape in New York.
We are out of time, and it's always such a delight for me to be able to talk to our outstanding controller here in New York, Tom DiNapoli, a man I much admire and who works very, very hard. So, Tom DiNapoli, thanks so much for giving us all this time. We always appreciate your showing up.
Alan, it's my pleasure.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.